All right, so I'm going to talk about gravitational lensing of the CMB. And so I'm assuming there's a wide range in people, ranging from Kendrick, who's, if not the world's expert, certainly him and Duncan, I don't know which one's in front, but to people that perhaps haven't thought very much about it. So hopefully we'll just span the gambit and everyone will get something out of this. So what am I going to talk about? Well, first I'm just going to give a quick overview of the CMB, just so we're all on the same page and so we can be thinking about temperature and polarization fluctuations, and I'll show some of the most recent SPT data. Then I'll talk about CMB lensing and exactly how we go about measuring that kind of stuff. Then, so once you've done CMB lensing, one of the things you get out of it is actually a map of all the mass in the universe in some piece of the sky, which means you can actually look at some spot and say, I know exactly how much mass there is right there, and you can then go look in galaxy or quasar catalogs and just see if you see more quasars and galaxies where you see mass, which is what should happen, and I'll show you that it does. And then I'll talk about how another thing you can do with these mass maps is you can actually use these to unlens the CMB as a way to go after primordial B-modes, which was much more exciting 6 months ago or so than possibly it is now. Some of the results I'll talk about are collected using the South Pole Telescope. So the South Pole Telescope is at the South Pole, and that's a very good spot to do millimeter wave astronomy because the air is super dry, and also the atmosphere is relatively thin. So it's a good millimeter site. And so the South Pole Telescope has gone through several iterations. So the first iteration was 2007 till 2012, where we had the SPT SZ camera. So that was not polarized. And it was at three frequencies. It was at 100, 150, 220. So that's around 1.4 to 3 millimeters. In 2012, we upgraded the cameras to SPT Pole, which is a polarization-sensitive camera, with roughly the same number of detectors. You know, it went up to maybe 1,600 from 960. And the end of next year, when people go down to Pole, the plan is to install the next-generation camera, which will, as you can see, have 15,000 detectors. So a factor of 10 or so in number of detectors, which means it'll be much, much faster. It'll have three frequencies, basically the same three frequencies we had before, and it'll be polarization sensitive. So in about a year or so, things will be very interesting. Well, things are interesting already. Until we get money for a new camera. But I think the nominal plan is to run for about 3 years. Yeah. So the plan is that basically we could do the whole survey area that we've done already with this camera. With this one, if we go for 3 years, we get to roughly 10 times the sensitivity. It's 10 times lower noise, so it's kind of a nice round number. The straw man is 3 years. But the details of how we observe and things like that are to be seen. So it's a big collaboration. So this is not just a McGill thing. So McGill is actually the only Canadian institute on here. So the center of mass of the collaboration is in Chicago. There's a lot of people in Berkeley as well. And McGill's probably number three in terms of the size of the group. So what are we doing with this? Well, so just follow the history of CMB. So it used to be a very low resolution map. And then COBE came along and sort of increased the resolution to a few degrees. Then WMAP really improved on this a lot. Now at this resolution, the Planck map would look exactly like this when I show the whole thing like that. So in order to actually see what Planck has done, you have to zoom in on a piece of the map. So here is WMAP at 60 gigahertz, and this is Planck at 143 gigahertz. And what you see is what happens is you go from WMAP to Planck. All this sort of small-scale structure, which is just noise, has gone away, and you're starting to be able to zoom in and see things like this, which is probably a bright radio source. And so this map here is 16 degrees. So now to see why you might want to use something like SPT, let's zoom in on this map. And now we zoom into a scale of about 4 degrees, and here's Planck on the left, and here's Planck plus SPT at roughly the same frequency, and you can again see that all the small-scale noise here is just not there by eye in the SPT map at this resolution. And again, you start to be able to see more of this small-scale structure. And so it's really just a way to zoom in on the small-scale structure in the cosmic microwave background. At a resolution kind of like this, we've now made a map that's 2,500 square degrees. So this is this SPT-SZ survey. So The final depths were, so our best science channel is 150 gigahertz, and we've got to 18 micro-k arc minute. So what does that mean? It means if you have a one arc minute pixel, the RMS is 18 microkelvin. Now, for comparison, the Planck stuff that's already been out, this number would be more like 40-something microkelvin. So we're more than a factor of two deeper than the stuff that Planck has put out already. However, you can see that we only have 2,500 square degrees, whereas Planck has the whole sky. So we're not a competitor to Planck. It's highly complementary is the way I would think about it. So what do people do with this? So CMB people, you take some map and you know, you look at this and you say, that just looks like noise, and it is. It's a Gaussian random field. So you take the power spectrum and you see the angular power spectrum of this map. Well, so partly this map, and then the Planck stuff was over the rest of the sky, and you see the angular power spectrum in units of, so this is power per log decade, and you see the acoustic peaks in the CMB. And so all this has four different experiments, Planck, WMAP, ACT, SPT. So WMAP is in green. You see that WMAP, the error bars start to blow up out here. Planck carries on and gets out to here, and then their error bars start to crap out a little bit. And then you have ACT and SPT, which carries on all the way out here, out almost to L of 3000, you can see CMB structure. So the CMB has been remarkably well characterized, and that's kind of what you can see in this map right here, that you really see all this large scale structure, and you don't see very much of this modeling in here, which is noise. So we really are imaging it. Yep?
The difference between ACT and SPT, again, a power spectrum plot like that, SPT's got loads more points than ACT. Just a function of binning, right? I mean, could ACT have been their data to look?
Well, so we have lower noise. So yeah, it's okay. Depends who you want to talk to. So we have slightly lower noise. So ours was 18 micro k arc minute, and ACT was something like 20 or 22. So we have slightly lower noise. So it should be very similar. But we have 2,500 square degrees, and they had about 600 or 700. So our error bars should be something like 2 times smaller if we use the exact same binning.
And so that's why you could have more.
Yeah. Noise. So that gives us finer resolution if that's what we choose to have. Yeah. So that's, you can see these dots, right? So yellow is obviously not the best choice for us to be showing to highlight our points. But yeah, so we have roughly comparable error bars, but you know, twice as many bins or something like that. I think that's this dotted line that goes right through the points. So lambda CDM is the chi-squared of lambda CDM. The reduced chi-squared is 1. So it's a good statistical fit to the data. So lambda CDM is a good description of this to as high out as we can measure it.
It's frighteningly good.
It's frighteningly good. It's annoyingly good is what it actually is, right? It would be nice if it actually showed something. So it's got some hints, but boy, you got to really squint to see some hints. So this is in temperature. So this is, in temperature is just the intensity, and you see that things work very well. There's also CMB polarization. So this is kind of, most of this is actually just noise, but it's a very vivid description of CMB polarization. This is from WMAP. And what you see is that, there's large-scale polarization structure in the CMB. That's mainly what that's supposed to show. So here is the K-band map, and almost everything you see here is actually just the galactic foreground. And so one way to describe polarization is as little headless vectors showing the direction of the E-field. So you think about showing headless vectors, what is that? That has some kind of an orientation and an amplitude. You could also parameterize that as Stokes Q and U, which is saying how much of these headless vectors are up and down versus side to side, and how many of them are at 45 degrees, which is U. So if you take this map and express it in terms of Q and U, you see there's lots of structure in U and lots of structure in Q, and you're picking out different aspects of this top map as you look in Q and U. You can see this thing right here is basically all in Q. You have things down here in U, but there's, in general, you could see that it might be useful to work in terms of Q and U, and that tells you lots about the polarization field. Now, here's a SPT pole data. So this is a map of the CMB over about 10 by 10 degrees. So this is coming out probably Wednesday or something like this. These maps will be, the maps won't be public, but the paper will be. So here are SPT, this is SPT pole data. There's the temperature map, here's a Stokes Q map, here's a Stokes U map. And over here is just the difference. This is basically a noise map right here that's made by just taking one half of our data, subtracting the other half so that anything that's on the sky goes away and all our noise just keeps adding. So the temperature map sort of has some structure, and that's the CMB that you're seeing. So the noise in this map is about three times deeper than anything that's been published before. So this has a noise of maybe 5 or 6 microkArc minute, where the SBTLC stuff was 18, Planck was more like 40. But here is Stokes Q, and here is Stokes U. And if you stare at this, you should be able to convince yourself that there's a lot of structure going mainly up and down in this one. And in this one, you're seeing a lot of structure at 45 degrees. So here, things are boxy, and here, things are at 45 degrees. If you stare at that for a second, you should be able to convince yourself that's true. And it's not just the projector, it's not just the image, it's actually, that's the way the CMB is. So in fact, if I was to take, let's see, this Q map and Fourier transform it, just a 2D Fourier transform. So instead of looking at exactly this map, I did it with a simulation, and just look at where the power is in this map. Just take this map, Fourier transform it, and what you'll get is you'll get something that looks like this. You'll get power along kx, power along ky, and a deep trough at 45 degrees. And that's what CMB maps generically look like in Fourier space. So just take this 2D boxy thing, FFT it, and what you get is all the power is along these axes. And similarly, if I did the same thing with the U map, I'd get all the power along here, and I'd get a deep valley along there. So, and this is something very peculiar about CMB maps, and these are what are known as E modes and B modes. So another way of talking about E modes and B modes is that in general, if you are a pure E mode, you spatially vary your polarization pattern in a direction that is picking out the polarization direction. So if it's polarized this way, it's going to vary in this direction. That's what an E mode means. A B mode is that it can be polarized like this, but the direction that it changes is along this horizontal. So it's a very particular symmetry of the CMB that, in general, for scalar fluctuations that are sourcing the CMB, all the polarization gets squeezed into this E mode pattern. So that's what E modes and B modes are. So there's, you know, everyone has their favorite way of thinking about it. Some people like to do it in spin 2 spherical harmonics. Some other people like to think of it as some kind of like a divergence-like thing and a curl-like thing. So I don't really like this one because this thing is clearly divergence-like, but I wouldn't think that's divergence-like. So I don't understand. But these are E modes and these are B modes. And so the main thing about B modes is they have some handedness to them, that if you reflect a B mode, you don't get the same thing back, you flip the sign, whereas if you reflect an E mode, it stays the same. So it's a parity thing. So why does CMB only cause E modes? Well, it's just because if you imagine that the CMB has some fluctuation in this direction, if this fluctuation is what's causing the local quadrupole, the position of an electron, Thompson scattering is going to generate polarization that picks out this orientation. So that's why it's only going to generate E modes. So that's what you see here. You see just, so these boxy things are E modes. We don't see, so I'm not going to talk about B modes today. So hopefully we'll have some B mode stuff coming out in a month or two. But today I'm only going to talk about E modes in terms of this kind of stuff.
This is my imagination. It doesn't look so boxy.
Yeah, that's because, so this one looks,
that one looks boxy.
This one looks boxy. This one is, it's because we scan the sky along this direction. And because we scan this way, atmosphere fluctuations generally will look like fluctuations this way. So when we filter out the atmosphere, we tend to filter out the lines a little bit. They're still there, but they're a lot lighter. The vertical stripes are much stronger here. So we have to take that into account in the analysis. That's exactly right. Okay, so there are the Q and U maps. We can turn those into E and B. So here are the E, this is an E map and this is a noise map. So our B map basically looks like this because we aren't imaging the B modes very clearly, but so what you see is that we're strongly detecting E modes in our data. So here's a stretch of plus or minus 20 microkArc minute. And what you see is that there's very little noise structure, very strong detection of emotes. And that's going to be relevant at the end of my talk, that we very clearly see emotes. It seems easy now that you look at this. You say, wow, you're making an image of the emotes. How did it take people so long to measure this? So you can take this emote map, and again, what do you do when you have some map that looks like a Gaussian random field? You take the power spectrum. So we have the power spectrum, and so this top one is the temperature emote cross power. So remember that the CMB is being sourced by the emotes, so those two things are going to be correlated. The bottom one is the emote power spectrum on its own. And so here you see WMAP. And so bicep 2 is way down here. These little tiny points right here with these little itty-bitty error bars is bicep 2 in the way we've plotted it. And so then you get all the acoustic peaks coming through. So you have bicep has this phenomenal measurement on large scales. No one ever talks about their emode measurements, but they have amazing emode measurements in terms of signal and noise. And then you have WMAP, and then you have all the different other experiments. So Quad is on here. Quad, for a long time, was one of the best measurements of emodes. And then just recently, so this week will be SPT poll. About a month ago was ACT poll. And you see that we're tracing out these acoustic peaks. And you go all the way out. So this line that's going through is actually, it does include the SPT poll data in a fit. So it is a best fit to all this data. But the best fit is indistinguishable from lambda CDM at something like 0.2 sigma or something like that. So the SPT poll data, if you do a global cosmological fit, even though this data looks very powerful, it turns out that those temperature power spectrum measurements are so powerful that they currently are just overwhelming any point that has an error bar that you can see. So the fact that you can see these error bars on here means that this data is going to just get completely swamped by the temperature data. Because remember that temperature power spectrum. In here, the error bars were effectively invisible in the spinning.
How much is this?
So this one is based on 100 square degrees. So SPT poll, the survey we're currently doing is 600 square degrees. So we're going to finish 600 square degrees at the end of next year. And that'll be at roughly the same sensitivity as this. So that's, we'll have a factor of 6 better sensitivity roughly than this plot right here. And then once 3G starts going, we'll have at least 2,500 square degrees. That's the plan. All right, so that's the CMB. And so remember what I said about these SPT pole maps imaging the emotes. Well, what's interesting about that is that you can actually do things like you can guess what the B modes are going to be. And we'll get to this a little bit later, but just for now, just because I wanted to get it all in one place. So here are the measured E modes. This is just a different color stretch on basically that same map. What you can do is you can actually guess what the gravitational potential is in the universe. And you can use that to guess what B modes there might be that have been generated by large-scale structure lensing these emodes. So remember, those emodes have that special symmetry to them. Well, if you lens them, that's going to wreck that nice symmetry, and you'll generate some spurious B-modes. So this is what Duncan Hansen did, is that he basically guessed what B-modes should be in the SPT data.
When you say guess by, you're going to...
So there's a bunch of different ways to guess it. So you could use a Herschel 500 micron map. You could use the a lensing map derived from the SPT data, or you can use a galaxy catalog from Spitzer. So there's all sorts of different ways you can guess what this phi should be, because honestly, you know, remember that it's just mass. So you look out there, you see where all the mass is, and you can guess what how much lensing is going on. And that tells you what the B should be, and then you just go look for this in your data. And when Duncan did this, what he found, lo and behold, is that in the SPT poll data, was a clear signature of the B modes from gravitational lensing. And so this was the first detection of B modes. And so it sort of came in the same, sort of the converse of the way Kendrick first detected gravitational lensing by cross-correlating a galaxy catalog with WMAP. So here, we use the galaxy catalog to dig out the B modes from the CMB map. And so this was a 7.7 sigma of B modes, but these are B modes from gravitational lensing. So these weren't the ones that people really were interested in.
Was that the first detection of 7.7 sigma?
Yeah. Well, people could have done it. Probably Quad could have done it. Yeah, Quad could have done it, for sure. But honestly, it had never occurred to, in retrospect, it seems like an obvious thing to do, but for whatever reason, this was not on anyone's radar. That one day, Duncan just sent me an email and said, hey, look, I see B-modes. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Good for you. So it actually made it a little tricky because once you realize how easy it was, you realize that anyone could do it. So you have to be careful who you tell because you realize that this was just sitting in everybody's data. And so it was pretty easy in the end. So this was the first detection of B modes, and we thought this was pretty good. But that was 2013. It was less than this came out about a year ago. But in between, obviously, a lot has happened, right? Because this isn't the only way to generate B modes. The way people are super interested in cosmological B modes is that gravitational waves generate both E and B. So remember, the temperature scalar, the scalar fluctuations only generate E modes because you have that only one preferred axis to work with. But as soon as you have these gravitational waves, you have the direction that it's propagating, plus you have the direction of the polarization of the wave. And that gives you another direction to work with. And so that can now let you generate B modes. And so a few months ago, what came out were the BICEP results. So BICEP 2 measured large angle CMB B mode polarization at L below 200. And this was interpreted by many people as gravitational radiation from inflation. Now, shortly thereafter, Polar Bear released some somewhat low significance, but still real measurements of B-mode anisotropy out here and from gravitational lensing. And so pretty soon, we should actually have some SBT points to put on here that'll span this region in here. Something interesting to note is that BICEP also sees some hint of these gravitational lensing B-modes. So it's not only this large angle stuff. Now, since then, I'm sure many of you are aware there's been talk about whether this theory spectrum for R of 0.2 is really the right one or if you should actually just put on some spectrum that looks like some dust power spectrum. We all have our opinions on that, but we'll just have to wait and see. My opinion is, oh boy, that's tough. It sure looks like it might be dust, is what I'll say, is that it sure looks like it. But before the Planck results came out, I never would have thought it was possible there was that much dust in that patch. And so what's changed is that Planck came along and the Planck measurements are very compelling. But it doesn't measure the exact, they don't have a clean measurement of how much dust is in that patch. And we're putting a lot of faith in a part of Planck that wasn't really designed to be doing B-mode measurements. Like their dust channel wasn't designed to be a cosmological B-mode experiment. So, if it came out that it turned out there was something in the 353 gigahertz that wasn't great for measuring super low sensitivity B-modes, that wouldn't surprise me. However, at face value, boy, it sure looks like dust.
If you have that frequency measurements, you can get frequency-dependent current, which would be side
rotation. Yes. If you had more frequencies, the problem is that they have to be close together because already part of the problem is that even going from BICEP at 150 gigahertz to Planck at 353, there's some amount of decorrelation between the bands because the dust is not a single frequency. It's not a single emitter with a known frequency. It's some superposition of emitters that all have slightly different spectral behavior. So that means if you measure some template at a higher frequency, it's not going to be perfectly correlated with the lower frequencies. So that's close enough that you think maybe that's not a big deal. But if you start adding more frequencies that are further away, it's not going to help. So what you really need is you need extremely sensitive measurements that are relatively close in frequency so you can actually make sure you're seeing the same components. So it's it. So we can do a little bit. So the one problem with SPT is, as Mike pointed out, those stripes were much more visible in the vertical direction than the horizontal direction, and that's because we do a bit of filtering on our data. And the scale of those stripes that we're filtering are right around here, which means we're filtering out this part of the data just naturally by, you know, our choice to make our analysis easy is to filter out this stuff down here so that we don't have to bother fighting with the atmosphere. And at the time, we didn't think that R was 0.2, so we weren't too worried about it. So now we're in this regime where now we have to go back and we have to start actually fighting, you know, we're actually going to dig into the atmosphere and try to get it out so we can actually do multi-frequency measurements down there. So we have lots of there's lots of stuff we can do out here, but the problem is so we can do the frequency part here, but then we have to do ... down to out of 50 or something. So in the foreseeable future, there's kind of a vacuum that I feels like for the next year or so, we're going to get a lot of hints about what's going on. But nothing's going to completely kill it until the next generation of sensitivity on these scales, which is probably at least a year or two off.
So, I understand correctly, you mean you have stored past data where the thing you had done for ease of analysis was basically kind of average out the atmospheric fluctuations.
Yeah.
Alternatively, you could have some other probe, or maybe you have some other data that...
No, it's the same. So we have the raw data. We have all our data sitting there. We didn't do it in hardware. We're just doing it in soft. The default map making, those maps that I showed, just the easiest thing to do is to filter out the structure down here. And that just means we don't have to fight with the atmosphere anymore. And that's what we did as a first pass through.
There's some other way to just internally within the data subtract out the atmosphere.
Yeah. Because the thing is, the atmosphere is not polarized. So, or not, you know, not detectably polarized. So in a polarization experiment, you actually, in principle, the atmosphere is completely gets differenced out if you're only looking for polarization. And the only way that it sneaks back in is to the extent in which you don't understand things like how your detectors are exactly polarized. So it sneaks back in, and if you want to just make sure it doesn't sneak in, you first just filter out the large-scale emission, and then you know that no atmosphere got through to your polarization maps. And so we were in this configuration where we weren't worried about the scales down here, and now we've started a new fork in the SPT analysis, which is now starting with not filtering that stuff out. But it's really just manpower limited at this point. We just need people to do it. So it's ongoing.
What about improving the dust maps?
Oh. Planck has the best polarized dust maps around.
Better dust
maps. Well, any ideas are welcome. Like, where do you get them? Where do you get a dust map? You know, it's one of these things where it's sort of fallen through the cracks, where it wasn't clear that people knew this was exactly what we needed. So it'll be interesting to watch. So I think
it probably wouldn't have been hard to get funding to make a good dust map until recently.
I think that's right. I think people who study dust now are rolling in money.
Science is a space we're doing.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, I mean, you don't know what you need. You know, it might have been that it was all synchrotron down here, not all dust. And then if they'd given all the money to the dust people, the synchrotron people would be come saying, look at you idiots, you gave all the money to the wrong people. You know, it's science, it's not linear. Yeah?
So I guess I'm trying to disentangle all this stuff. So SPT must have had a sense when they set out to do this experiment that dust was going to be an issue, and I'm wondering why maybe you were alluding to that just 30 seconds ago, but why did it get this far without having planned for a proper control for the dust emission in that patch?
Well, so if you look at the predictions for how much dust there should have been, it's actually more like down here. The dust wasn't thought to be an issue until you got an order of magnitude lower in R. And so it turns out that what Planck is saying is that dust is incredibly polarized. So if you look at a galaxy and some other galaxy, and you measure the polarization fraction, you say, okay, how much thermal emission is coming out, and what's the polarization fraction? You get a few percent. So you find that other galaxies are polarized at the level of a few percent. And so you would think, oh, well, dust emission is a few percent polarized. So if we're looking out through our galaxy, you'd expect it to be a few percent polarized. What Planck is finding is that if you look through some extremely low column area of dust, it's not a few percent polarized, it's more like 20% polarized. And then it comes into this as squared, because it's power. And the reason for that is there's a physical reason for it, which is that if you look at a galaxy, most of the emission is coming from the center of the galaxy. You know, you're looking through the disk of this thing or through many regions. And you see many different regions that all have magnetic fields that are aligned at different angles. And so the polarization fraction will average down. But if you choose a particularly low column part of our galaxy, you're probably only going through maybe one or two of these little regions. And what you get is you end up with the magnetic field being incredibly coherent, and it doesn't average down. And so in retrospect, you think, okay, that's not crazy that it would be that high. But even 20% is bumping into what some people say is a theoretical limit for how polarized dust emission from a single region could be. Because the mechanism for polarization is not very, it's not perfectly understood. So, it really was a surprise to most people that it was this polarized.
Local polarization structure in like M31.
Well, the thing is that it's the contrast is too big. So if you imagine in your mind a CMB map, there's just not that much dust. There's none, there's no red at high latitude. That the contrast between the galactic center and off-axis is like at least is more than a factor of 100. Which means if you look at M31, you just can't see the dust emission that's coming from these high latitude regions. It's just too tenuous that you're dominated by the disk. So it's one of these things that's turned out that it turns out this is way harder than we thought. So I remember writing down words saying dust emission shouldn't be a problem. And you just say dust is a few percent polarized, you take this much emission from this region, and you say that you don't have to worry about that until you're pushing down here. And it didn't seem crazy to me when I wrote it down. But then you see the Planck data and you go, oh man, that's crazy.
And you're pretty sure that what Planck is saying is correct.
Kendrick is, I'm sure. Right? Kendrick is sure. Well, this is the first time nature has made CMB difficult. So the old lore in the CMB was there's some classic line about how the foregrounds are going to screw you to the wall, because everyone was assuming that you wouldn't be able to do a temperature power spectrum because you'd be swamped by all these foregrounds. And it turned out the temperature foregrounds are remarkably low, all things considered, that the CMB is this huge source of emission. But it turns out in polarization, there's this one nasty surprise. But it's one of these things where we're only now seeing hints that it's a problem. It could be that in 2 months, someone's going to say, oh, it's actually really easy to get rid of this, and then we'll be right back on track again. So who knows? Or maybe it's not foreground at all, and it's gravitational radiation. I don't know. So there are people that are actually doing an internal comparison of Bicep and Planck in the same region. And if it is all dust, they should see that pretty clearly. Well, somewhat clearly. If it's a mix of a little bit of gravity waves and a little bit of dust, then things won't get sorted out for years. Okay, so let's talk about this bump now. So what is this bump? Well, that bump is coming from CMB lensing. And CMB lensing is very simple, that what you see is this signal right here at some spot in the sky. You see some lens pattern, and it's coming not from where you think it is, but from some offset. So you think it's coming from here. It's actually coming from here, and then it's been navigating through the universe. And so you are projecting into the wrong spot. So you would think that if you have some Gaussian random field and you perturb it with some effectively Gaussian random field, that you wouldn't be able to detect that. But the thing is that what you'll end up doing is you're starting with something that is basically maximally random. So if you do something to it which has correlations in it, like you take all this part of the sky and move it this way and this part of the sky and move it that way, you've broken that randomness to some extent. And so you can go looking for that signal. So the simplest way to think about, at least in the temperature, what it's doing, is imagine you have some perturbation on the sky in temperature that looks like this, and it goes through some part of the sky that's acting as something that's shrinking the sky. Well, you had some pattern that looks like this, now you have some pattern which is smaller, you've changed the characteristic wavelength of that pattern, you've kept the intensity the same, but you actually know, in general, exactly how large the intensity fluctuations should be for fluctuations of this wavelength from that angular power spectrum that I showed. That angular power spectrum is extraordinarily well characterized. So if you see some for a given wavelength perturbation, you know exactly what the distribution of amplitude should be. So schematically, all you need to do is go looking for spots in the sky where the amplitudes of the fluctuations on various scales have the wrong size. And so that's convergence. Shear does something similar. What shear does, it takes some pattern of fluctuations that was this way, and it basically just turns it. So that's what shear is going to do. And so remember, those E modes had that very strong symmetry to it. You're going to lens that. That strong symmetry suddenly gets rotated, but the polarization direction doesn't. So lensing doesn't change polarization. It only changes positions, which means if you had this nice polarization pattern where the polarization was either upper or down, it'll still have that same cross-shaped polarization, but now it's propagating in the wrong direction, which means you've generated B modes. So that's the way it works. We can skip over that. So, you know, one way to think about it is you have this spatially varying power spectrum. A more mathematically convenient way to think of it is as mode coupling. You started with this nice Gaussian random field, and then you've done something to it. And then you just do some expansion on this, and what you see is it's this nice Gaussian random field that you started with, plus this grad t piece dotted into this. And so if you then take the two-point function in Fourier space, you find that there's some connected piece that's proportional to the gravitational potential. And so what that's saying is that you've coupled modes in Fourier space, so this Fourier mode is now coupled to this Fourier mode by some gravitational potential mode of length like this. And so there's mode coupling. So now all you have to do is go build some filter that says, well, how correlated are these two modes with each other? So for a Gaussian random field, they're completely uncorrelated. If you have lensing in place, these two things now have some small amount of correlation. You measure how much correlation they have, and that tells you the gravitational potential. So you can do that as a way to reconstruct the gravitational potential. And so the formal way, the optimal way to do it in some limits is the Hu and Okamoto quadratic estimator, or you can iterate on that to do something more formally correct, but we're just using a quadratic estimator to do this. So with SPT, we did this. We made this lensing map over 2,500 square degrees, and the signal noise on this is, the biggest fluctuations you see in here are 5 sigma mass fluctuations. So that's a 5 sigma fluctuation, and that's a -5. And the noise level is around, so it's 5 sigma. So it's a Gaussian random field, so you have to be careful with your sigmas. But the largest fluctuations are 5 times bigger than the noise. Let's put it that way. So that spot right here almost certainly corresponds to a big lump of mass. So if you had some galaxy survey, you could go look and say, is there a big lump of mass there? And so we've started on that. And something to be aware of is that, so this is from the last release of Planck, so presumably in something like a month. there'll be a new version of this, which will be something like 2 times better, but this is an all-sky map of the gravitational potential. So pick a spot on the sky, go download the Planck map, and you can figure out exactly how much gravitational potential or mass there is at every spot in the sky, other than where these holes are.
That's a column. All the way back to the...
That's right. All the way back to the CMB, you have some single, at every spot, you have an integrated number.
But are they dominated by individual galaxy clusters? So, you know, are they dominated by one or two things, or are they really...
So it's mainly dominated by large-scale structure. So if you just calculate the variance at some spot in the sky, integrated through everything. Most of that, so it you know, sort of logarithmically diverges, but for the most part, you're dominated by the large-scale structure. And so this is dominated by, you know, if you imagine those n-body simulations with the filaments, it's stuff on scales that is even larger than the typical separation between those filaments. So it's really the large-scale structure, degree-scale fluctuations.
Okay, so you're not going to point at one and say, oh, that's your favorite.
It's not going to be your favorite galaxy.
Yeah, galaxy cluster. Or, you know, it's 10 galaxy clusters somewhere around, you know, somewhere in
the world. So it's somewhat true. Now, for SPT-3G, so that with high enough resolution, you can push the resolution of this mass map so that you can start weighing galaxy clusters. So we're nowhere near that yet. So in a couple of years, it will be true that if you take not your a single galaxy cluster, but a group of maybe 10 galaxy clusters, and you could calculate an average mass for those, it'll be you'll detect them at a few sigma. So, but it's not what it's best for. That's really leaning on the data down to the finest scale resolution. It's really mapping the large scale structure. Yep.
So with a map, I mean, it's all this very large scale stuff, and everything's linear.
Yeah.
How much do you start to get systematic limited by nonlinear modeling for something like SPT?
Yeah, so it's a little bit funny because this mode coupling, you're coupling together CMB modes, and so you're reconstructing the large, you know, modes of a given big L, which are typically large scale, and you're using small scale structure to do it. And so as you push to the smaller and larger, higher and higher L, which is what SPT does, you're still largely reconstructing the large scale structure pretty well. Now, as you go to you know, smaller and smaller scales in this big L, then you have to start worrying about nonlinear clustering, but that's generally on the order of about a 10% effect until you get out to L past 2,000 or so. So it's, for a while, we'll be safe, because as we'll see, we don't measure those scales very well. Yeah?
One more question. You said the kernel peaks at 2, but that's, I think, for, is that for a fixed potential? So that you fold in the fact that potential's evolving.
Right. So if you're doing it in potential, the potential is constant.
Potential is constant until very late times.
Yeah. So the meat of the kernel is kind of redshifts of 2 to 5. Mm-hmm. You do actually end up getting an extra kick from low redshift because things have gone sufficiently nonlinear that the nonlinear structure starts to give you a boost. If you could isolate that piece. And so it turns out you can actually see galaxy surveys better than you would think if you just use linear theory. But the meat of it is redshifts, well, maybe 1 or 1.5 out to about 5. That's the meat of this. Yep.
When are you going to be saying something about dark matter?
Well, we only measure total matter, right? So all we have is total mass. So whether it's dark or baryonic, you know, I mean, we all have our guesses for what it is, but we just have the full column. So we can't break it into dark and dark versus baryon. But you know, it's certainly true that if there are theories that replace dark matter with something else, if it has a different lensing signature, it would show up here. So if it affects geodesics of photons, then it'd be interesting to see what it does. So in addition to the SPT SZ and SPT and Planck, there are also these new maps that are coming out in a few weeks. So the E-mode power spectrum should be this week. This should be next month. Using SPT pole, we can generate lensing maps. So this right here is that same 100-degree patch that I showed earlier, and here is a map of lensing. And so minimum variance just means we've combined a bunch of different ways of looking at it. And so what's interesting here is that we can look at how the modes are coupled in temperature to generate a lensing map. We can look at how the E modes are coupled to the B modes to generate a lensing map. We can look at how temperature and polarization are coupled to generate a lensing map. Or we can look at how different E modes get coupled. So there's all sorts of different mode couplings going on. And they're all sourced by the same underlying potential. So you can actually look at all these different ways and then try to combine them. So it turns out the highest signal noise is in the temperature one right now. And the next highest signal noise is from looking at how E modes and B modes are coupled. But in the end, we end up with a mass map that looks like that. And just to give you a sense of how good these maps are, here's a simulation. Here's a simulated observation of one of our fields. Here's the signal that went into this observation, and here's the noise. So when you look at this map, basically anything that's bright on here is an honest-to-God big lump of mass that's out there in the universe, and we should get telescopes on there to find out what's going on. So that's one way, one thing you can do with this. On the other hand, it's a map with a bunch of blobs in it, so what do you do with it? You take the power spectrum. And so here's what it was a year ago. So this is from Planck. So these boxes are the Planck lensing power spectrum. So this is the power spectrum of that big sphere with the cutout pieces. Red points are how the Atacama Cosmology Telescope did. These yellow points are things that my student Alex Van Engelen did in 2012. And so what you see is that you're tracing out these matter fluctuations. So the nonlinear stuff starts to matter out around here. So that's when you have to start worrying about nonlinearity. And the line here is lambda CDM, but not even a fit to this data. This is just the fit to the temperature power spectrum. And yeah, this is the fit to the Planck temperature power spectrum. And so what you see is that lambda CDM is doing fine. So maybe, and we'll see this now actually, so we'll add the SPT points. So here's the SPT pole points. So this is the stuff that's coming out soon. That's these blue ones. And again, this black line is the fit to the Planck temperature data. So blue is SPT pole, yellow is ACT, purple are the stuff my student did, and Planck is, where's Planck? Planck is only here in the green. And so depending on how you look at that, you might be able to convince yourself that there's possibly, might be a little bit low. And if you actually do a fit, you'll find that it is slightly low, but it's not too bad. But in general, this is not a sign that lambda CDM is broken. This is, we've definitely have not discovered new physics that way. That's, I think we can all agree on that. So what's interesting is that for the first time we actually have one of these power spectra. We can split it into combined temperature and polarization, which is the blue, or we can do the polarization only, which is the red. And so this polarization only is still something like a 4 or 5 sigma detection of lensing, which is the strongest detection to date in polarization. So that's using the power spectrum. And so one thing you could do with this is telling you the amplitude of matter fluctuations at a redshift of 3 or so. And what you see is that it's roughly what you'd expect them to be from lambda CDM, but it's not yet a super precise probe. So the new Planck data should be at least on the order of a factor of 2 better than what it is now. So it should start getting interesting. So what else can you do with this stuff? Well, you know, you have honest-to-God mass fluctuations. You should go see if they show up in galaxy catalogs. So Planck did this. So Planck compared their lensing map with NVSS quasars, which is what Kendrick did with WMAP. This is how lensing was first discovered. You can use Max BCG clusters. This is galaxy clusters from Sloan. You can use galaxies in WISE. You can use SDSS, luminous red galaxies. And what you see is that in general, where you see a little, where you see a hotspot in that lensing map, you see extra quasars or extra clusters or extra galaxies, as you would expect. I mean, this is just saying that in general, galaxies tend to live where there's more mass. Yeah, that's how you get the error bars. Yeah, so, and it goes both ways, right? You see more where there, you know, you say, are there extra galaxies where there's extra mass? Is there a dearth of galaxies where there's a dearth of mass? And you can just do it by eye. I'll actually show that in a sec. So you can do this with quasars. So we did that, but I think the clearest one is this. So here's a paper that's been submitted already. It's not on the archive, though. So here's the Planck lensing map right here, smooth on degree scales. And then here's a piece of it. And so what's been done here is it's the Sloan Digital Sky Survey quasar catalog cross-matched with WISE, which is an infrared satellite, and then just smoothing the AGN number density in this patch. So there's no details on here other than to say that there's a big patch. This is, you know, many tens of degrees. This is about 100 degrees this way and 60 degrees this way. So it's a huge swath of the sky, as you can see. And all you're doing is comparing where there's a cold spot or a hot spot in the lensing map with where you see fewer or more quasars. And just by eye, it works out that if you do a stack, like you take all the spots in that AGN map that have either, say, a deficit, so underdense by a factor by, you know, 0.2, and you just add together all of the CMB convergence maps. So take a slice, take a single color on this map, say blue, take all the spots that are this blue, and then calculate the mean flux in this map. So you do that, and what do you find? You find that where you're missing quasars, where this is negative, you are indeed missing CMB convergence, and where you have extra quasars, you have extra CMB convergence. So this is just, you know, doing by eye, well, doing quantitatively this test, which is to say, is it both ways? Do you see extra quasars where there's more mass and fewer quasars where you're missing mass? And then you can do things like you do shifts, to make sure that it has the right mean and that you get a zero correlation, as you must if you have two uncorrelated maps. Yeah?
This is how you get the redshifts, I assume. So you said it's somewhere between 2 and 3. So these are redshift 2 and 3 quasars.
So these are quasars that are typically around a redshift between 1 and 2. That's kind of, I think it peaks at around 1.5. So this isn't all of the mass. So the thing is that a lot of the actual CMB lensing mass is behind these quasars. And all that does is it adds noise to this, because that's that structure that's not correlated with the quasar distribution. It's uncorrelated stuff, which just adds noise to the measurement. So it's not a one-to-one correlation. It's just that there's a slice of mass that the quasars are correlated with. And when you average over many, many different lines of sight, it picks out that bit that has that extra bit of correlation. So what I can't quite figure out is what to do with this. So you do a power spectrum, because that's what we always do. So you do a cross spectrum, and you see it's clearly non-zero. It's a huge signal. And what people, one thing you could do with it is you could measure the bias of quasars. So in this paper, what we were doing was comparing the galaxy bias of obscured quasars versus unobscured quasars. So it turns out some of these AGNs are very bright in the infrared, and you barely see them in the optical, and some of them are bright in the infrared and in the optical. And you can use, and those are obscured versus unobscured, and people argue about whether that's due to orientation, maybe there's just dust hiding them. So I'm not an expert on the science, but if anyone here is, what we're finding is that obscured quasars look like they're slightly more clustered, that these red points are a little bit higher than the blue points. So we've also done this with Planck lensing crossed with CFHT lens galaxies. So CFHT lens is basically an analysis of the CFHT legacy survey, and it's just a big galaxy catalog, and here's the redshift distribution. And so it typically goes from maybe 0.3 out to redshift, it's even by 1, they're basically dead. But what you see is this is the lensing kernel, and even though it's not peaking until you get out past redshift to 1.5, there's still overlap down here. So you still see some stuff. And so this is kind of where we've hit what I'm curious about, which is, so they're clearly quite strongly correlated. This is the cross power spectrum between Planck lensing and CFHT lens galaxies, and you see that there's a clear non-zero signal. There's a 5-sigma detection. The galaxies are biased at the level of order 1. But for comparison, here is our data for, well, so this is Planck cross the galaxies, and what you see is that there's clearly a detection. But if you do the same analysis, except instead of doing CMB lensing crossed with galaxies, instead do just galaxies clustered with themselves, you get these things right here, which are points with error bars on them. And what this says, and if you do the same analysis, we fit to this galaxy bias and we get plus or minus 0.3 or 0.2. If you do this with galaxies themselves, you get a 1% measurement of galaxy bias. And what that means is that just studying galaxies on their own, we think we have a really good model for exactly how galaxies are tracing mass. And so the question is, what gets added by adding a 20% measurement of something that galaxy people on their own think they're measuring to 1%? And I think this comes down to a style thing, which is, do you want external checks or are internal checks good enough? However, at the level of a 20% measurement, I'd like to get input from people that study galaxy properties to get their thoughts on that, maybe after the talk. Okay, so I'll finish with one last thing, which are the lensing B modes. So here are the lensing B modes. Here are theory curves from a paper by Kendrick. And so here is the B mode power spectrum. And here are different gravity wave signals. And these are the lensing B modes. So the lensing B modes look like white noise with 5 μK arc minute. And what you see is that if you really wanted to be measuring B modes down at the level of a few percent, you need to subtract out these lensing ones. And this goes by the name of delensing. That it'd be, if you wanted to measure this power spectrum really well, you've got to get rid of these. So how would you do that? Well, so we just do the same thing that was done before. You measure the E modes really, really well. You come up with an inspired guess for what the phi field is. You predict the B modes, but now instead of trying to detect them in your data, you just subtract them out. And if your guess for what phi is good enough, you can get rid of the B modes from lensing, and the only ones left will be the inflationary ones. So to get a sense of which E modes you need to measure, if you want to measure B modes at L of, say, 500 or below, you need to measure E modes that are around the same scale, just a little bit smaller. So you need relatively large-scale E modes, but the phi modes are way out here on degree scales. So you need a degree scale measurement of the gravitational potential, and that's basically good enough in order to get rid of all of the lensing B modes. And why would you want to do that? Well, so, you know, here's the plot of B modes as they stand today. There are the bicep points, there are the polar bear points. Here is R of 0.2, there's R of 0.01, there's 0.001. And so what would be nice if you really wanted to be probing what's going on with these points would be if you could get this blue curve out of there. And that's what you want to do with delensing. So what we were interested in was whether you could measure the tilt of this thing. Because, I mean, for me, the lesson, when people talk about probing inflation today, no one ever talks about using the amplitude A sub S as a probe of inflation. So why are we talking about R as a probe of inflation? And the thing is that there are some fluctuations in the scalar field, but when people argue about whether it's actually inflation or not, what they go straight to is N sub S, which is the tilt. And it's because A sub S is the amplitude of the scalars. That tells you something about what the slope of the potential was during inflation, but it's one number. In the same way that R is telling you the energy scale of inflation, but that's still just one number. I don't think anyone really cares whether it's 1.1 or 1.2 10 to the 15 GeV. People care whether it's gut scale or electroweak scale. And so if you really want to be talking about the physics of what's going on, I think what you really want to be measuring is the scale dependence of this. So it's sort of this, there's one number you want, which is, are there tensors? What's the order of magnitude of the tensors? But if you want to go to the next step, which is actually really getting into the details of what's going on, I think where you want to go is with the slope of that thing. And that's N sub T, and that's really hard to measure. So here's going from 0.5 to minus 0.5 in the tensor B modes, and what you see is that that the spread in these in this purple is sort of fairly small, and that you don't really start to see it until you're digging into this lensing tail. So what you need to do is delensing. So if you just want to do a forecast of how well you can measure that tensor tilt, what you'll find is that until you get down to below a μK arc minute, it's going to be really hard, for one. And for two, what we were finding is that actually you are fine using just this cosmic infrared background for doing the delensing. That same guess for what the potential is that we used before, that's a perfectly good guess for which B modes you have until you start getting down to extremely low sensitivities, which won't be until SPT3G. All right, so the summary is that gravitational lensing is a powerful new probe. I hope you got that out of this. That lensing of the temperature fluctuations is now pretty mature. There's lots of measurements of this. There's Planck, there's SPT, ACT has this. So there's lots of measurements of this that are around. And these maps exist. So you want to know what the mass is at that spot in the sky? That exists. So just go look. Lensing and polarization is now coming online, and that is the long-term future of this, is in polarization. And also, B-mode polarization anisotropy is detected. So the lensing B-modes were measured by SPT, BICEP2, and Polar Bear. We need to think about how to get rid of these lensing B-modes on the path to figuring out what's going on with the inflationary B-modes. All right, that's it. You don't. So the thing is that the lensing, the mode coupling from lensing is very particular. That there's a, it has that pattern that two modes get coupled together, that two modes that are this far apart in Fourier space are always coupled together by the same amount, no matter what their intrinsic scale is. So L of 1000 and L of 1200 are coupled together at exactly the same amount as L of 2000 and 2200. And the same as 1500 and 1700. And the orientation matters as well. So it's a very particular form of mode coupling. But if there was some pixie at last scattering that was just going around and, you know, moving spots around superluminally, there would be no way you could detect that. Right? So it's sort of a leap of faith that you say, well, we don't see any other non-Gaussianity that looks anything like this. So it'd be pretty weird to see this particular form of non-Gaussianity and only this one, and not the one that looks kind of like it, but not quite. So, but in the end, you can't prove it.
How accurate are the Shear measurements?
I mean, how is this compared to a Shear? So in principle, Shear should be completely blowing away all things in CMB lensing. So here's my guess at putting these on the same plot. So the power spectra I was showing would be, so here's this lensing power spectrum. And current error bars would be something like this blue, or maybe even this purple, somewhere in there. And in principle, we should someday be getting down to sort of error bars on the power spectrum, which are absurdly small. But if you just compare things in terms of noise levels, so here's where Planck is, here's where SPT-SZ is. SPT pole, that stuff I showed you, is about here. Next generation will get down to here, but over a much larger field of view. But we're still a factor of several above what the equivalent would be for a plot like this for cosmic shear. If you were to take some 10 to 20 galaxies per square arc minute for sources at redshift of 1 or 2 and compared that with the CMB lensing. So in principle, cosmic shear maps, this is not a crazy density of sources, and so that CFHT lens, the galaxy catalog I was comparing with, they have made mass maps, but those mass maps don't seem to be anywhere near this level of signal noise on degree scales, and I'm not sure why. What was that?
11 galaxies per square.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, there's slop in this. But it doesn't seem as if those maps are signal noise of 10 on degree scales, which surprises me. They should be. They should be better. Like when, so the person who I've seen show these and who's published stuff on is Ludo van Verbeke. And when he shows the maps, you have to squint to believe things. And it seems like if you're at this level of signal noise, you shouldn't have to squint. It should just be obvious. You should just see features that exactly match up between different probes of large scale structure. So in principle, CMB lensing should be complementary to shear-based measurements. It should always be slightly lower signal noise, and I think there might actually be a principle that makes that true that I haven't quite managed to formalize. But currently, they're quite competitive. And the one thing that CMB has going for it is that it's all sky. Like Planck, there's an all sky map. So the CFHT lens stuff, that's maybe, 150 square degrees or something like that total. And, you know, with Planck, you have an all-sky map already. And it's only going to get better. So it's interesting.
Euclid will come.
Euclid and W first. Euclid and W first will be there. And so at that point, what CMB lensing will be offering is the fact that it goes all the way out to redshift 1100. And so you could think of Euclid as measuring all the stuff that's at redshift below 2-ish. So from redshift 0 to 2, you can use this, these cosmic shear surveys to measure the mass distribution at redshift 2. And you could subtract that off from your CMB lensing map, and then you have this map of everything from redshift 2 out to redshift 1100. And so it's you know, it has a future as the way, the only way to probe the mass at high redshifts.
Any questions for Gil? Thank you.